Blog Talk Radio.
Grandfather and uncle's father used to take me for my birthday every year on my birthday, April 23rd. And it is coming. I don't know the birthday. Anyway.
It's like that every year, I hear.
That's right. So I used to go twice a year.
Nice.
And it was fabulous. And the Three Ring Circus, my uncle used to say, boy, he said it was so spectacular. Guys would be shot out of a cannon. Lions were eating people's arms off. He said, what was Michael doing? He was counting the house. How many people were counting the house? Well, you know, people were interesting to me. Always been interesting. But and as we get back to Life is a Three-Way Circus, you know, I think that song was really dedicated to the GOP.
Well, anything to do with the circus these days is their territory.
They are the big, big circus. I mean, I want to tell you.
They've given up on the big tent.
Oh, yeah.
It's
no longer a big tent. It's a three-ring circus. They have the conservative wing, which is the evangelical wing. They have the NAMBLA wing, I guess what they refer to it as, the NAMBLA wing. The gay, yes, NAMBLA, according to Dr. Ben Carson. The NAMBLA wing.
I thought that was senator or whatever came up with it. Wasn't it Vitter or something?
No, that was
Man Love.
No, that, yeah, but recently it was Ben Carson. Dr. Ben Carson. I don't know who the hell would send their child to that pediatric. Anyway, so, and then they have the Tea Party Ring. So they are a three-ring circus. A three-ring circus.
Exactly.
Now, when they say the NAMBLA wing of the Conservative Party, I'll bet you there's at least, if that flathead, what's his name down there in Florida that lost the colonel? What was his name? You know that
Colonel Flathead.
Colonel Flathead, stupid. The guy down there in Florida. The black guy, you know.
Oh, Mr. Pizza?
No, Alan West. If Alan West says there's 78 to 81 communists in the Democratic Progressive Caucus, I believe there's 78 to 81 NAMBLA people in the Republican Party.
Well, you can tell them by their wide stance.
Oh, yeah. Wide stance. So what are we talking about here?
And you got to remember, sometimes they're outside the room on the street corner with Bitter, you know, picking up some prostitutes.
Absolutely.
So you may not find them in that room.
That's right.
However, they're there.
And then you could still vote for them because you could be like Governor Sanford, come back and say, oh, yes, please forgive me, and vote for me again.
Exactly right.
And vote for me again.
It's kind of like, you know,
I have a new wife. Ain't she gorgeous?
Yeah. I picked up a few ticks on the Appalachian Trail, but I'm okay.
Give me a break. Anyway, we have this clown, Stephen Moore.
Stephen Moore.
Stephen Moore.
So what? Tell me some more about this.
Tell you some more about Stephen Moore.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Moore is a, what can I say? He loves to help. He loves to just talk about how great the Republican Party is and how moderate they are and how they...
Moderate. I like that term.
Yes, how moderate they are and how they really believe that everything they say is just for the people. And as Rush Limbaugh said about guns, listen.
None of these proposals would have stopped the shooter in Newtown, Connecticut. None of them.
None of them.
There is no such thing as an assault weapon, by the way. An assault weapons ban is a catch-all term, but there is no such thing as an assault weapon. That's not an official category. If they could write their ticket, if they could, they would eliminate guns. And there are a whole host of reasons why, and safety is probably not in the top five. I say it in a non-threatening way, in an attempted humorous way. The wet dream plan for eliminating guns in this country has been a plan that the left has had for years, and it's been sitting in a drawer somewhere waiting to be pulled out at the appropriate time, just like health care was.
Spoken.
By
a master and a true American hero who fought in not one but two wars and knows. I lie. I know.
Yeah, you lie totally. I mean, what, the war for?
He knows all about guns because he has shotguns and he has been fired at. Pipple on his ass and everything. This man, Rush Limbaugh, believe me, he knows what he's talking about when he says, I know I am smarter than anybody with one hand tied behind my back.
With one brain tied behind his back?
Yes. Yeah. Well, this is what he says. Now, this Stephen Moore and Rush Limbaugh talking about science from someone who knows nothing about science. This guy, Stephen Moore, who works for the Wall Street Journal, was talking, was pointing out to, was being pointed out by Zach Copeland, who is a science education activist. He pointed out to Moore, who questioned need for funding research on snail mating habits. He says, that's not science, Stephen Moore said, who failed science in high school and college.
And this would be exactly why he's being corrected by a science
educator. Absolutely. He said, it turns out the real reason actual scientists are conducting this type of research is because snails carry parasites, parasitic worms that kill children. Watch where you jump in for a swim or where you bathe water comes from, where your bath water comes from, especially if you live in Africa, Asia, or South America. Snails that live in tropical fresh water in these locations are intermediaries between disease-causing parasitic worms and humans. Of course, when Moore heard the word parasitic worms,
he thought they were from that brush.
So this is the reason why this, it says it's growing in the developing countries, but what the hell is in the water in Arkansas? It's oil.
Yeah, they don't have to worry about parasitic worms there.
They got oil. They don't have to worry about parasitic worms. Moore is not a fringe right winger. Now, this is true. He's not a fringe right winger. He's a senior economic writer and economic board member of the Wall Street Journal. And while on national television, he called for killing of government-funded scientific studies while bragging about not understanding the research behind.
As usual. I mean, this is a, look, we've talked about this a thousand times. These Republicans are the, and I love to use this term, but they're the modern-day know-nothings, like in the 18th century. The ones that were against science, against progress, against learning, you know, the ones that tried to defeat public education and everything back then. Same thing again. These are they don't want education, they don't want science. We don't need science. We got the Bible. We don't need to know how anything or why anything works. Sit at home and better yet, stay in your shelter that you dug underneath your home and wait for the apocalypse. I mean, that's what these people live for.
And we're going to talk about that to a gentleman that we now have on the phone who happens to be the Democratic leader in the North Carolina House of Representatives. And he represents District 5, Whitehall. Your Honor.
How are you doing this afternoon?
That was his first single that scored in the
100. How are you doing this afternoon?
I am doing fine. How are you doing?
Doing great, doing great. Great to hear your show, and as usual, you're really putting it out there so people can understand it.
Well, I hope so, and I definitely have the pleasure of having the head man of the Democrats, fighting the fight. You're the only one I know that doesn't wear armor. You must be bulletproof.
Well, again, you don't want to misunderstand the danger of what is happening here in La Land. So to keep a heightened sense of how serious things are, I don't want to wear any more armor than the citizens wear.
Yes, true. You mentioned at a
I have to say, because I just saw the laws that they passed this week. I hope that you're speeding up out there on the road so you don't get run over by people.
Well, I think our Republican leadership has yet to figure out the responsibility they have that goes along with the authority of being the majority party and being in leadership.
Well, as you so eloquently said, speaking about the other party, and I call them the regressive party because they're no longer the Republican party, Mr. Edgar Starnes said something that you told us last week. Could you repeat that for our listening audience?
Well, now, and again, some of your listening audience may know Whitney Houston and may recall her husband was Bobby Brown. He had a song that he put out called It's My Prerogative, I Can Do What I Want to Do. And Edgar Starnes has come up with his own piece of entertainment. He says, we got elected. We're going to do what we want to do. We don't care what you think, and we are not going to apologize. So, in effect, he said, because they're in charge right now in the majority, they can do whatever they want to do, and you see some of these laws that are absolutely crazy that we're passing and filing bills for, from creating your own religion to anything else you want to talk about, and taking away people's authority for the public utilities and the investments they made over many years. So, again, they said because they're in charge, they can do whatever they want to do. Even if they're wrong, they don't have to apologize or be responsible. They just proceed on.
Well, you know, as the majority leader for the Democrats in North Carolina, some 43, 44 million people, am I correct?
About 4.5 million, 43 House seats spread across the state from the coast to Asheville and Buncombe County. So we represent the whole state, a sampling of all the different areas and regions, and we don't yield on ideas to anyone because of their numbers. Because
right.
You have the superior numbers does not mean you have the superior ideas, doesn't even mean you have any common sense. It just means there are a lot of you.
Right.
Well, remember, that's one of their prime wars now is against common sense, just like their war on science.
War on education, war on women, war on education, war on science. Look like once these guys won the battle at the ballot box, they don't know when to accept victory and go home. They want to just keep fighting and seem to be mad at someone. But they're in charge, so you wonder, are they mad at themselves?
Mike and I are longtime nerds this way, but we used to sit around watching The X-Files, and they had a movie called Fight the Future. And that's what the Republicans stand for now. They have this fear of change, this inherent fear that, the future is somehow out of their control, and they want it all to return back to some mythological, dreamy, perfect paradise that it was in the 18th century or something, where everybody can sit around at and have tea, or something. I don't know what the deal is, but they are absolutely terrified with our societal and scientific cultural changes that are going on, and they are trying to just, by brute force, undo everything.
Well, we had a bill filing date that happened this week, and so it may be too late to file it, but we had discussed at one time doing a omnibus act that we would call the 18th Century Restoration Act, and just go ahead and file that and put into law the fact that the state of North Carolina would just go back to what it was in the 18th century and let Republicans have what they want instead of them having to do it piece by piece.
Right, right. That's fantastic.
Well, you have a major role in North Carolina. What is your steps? And I don't want you to give away any secrets, but what are you planning on doing, you and the rest of your core of, you know, like the Marine Corps, which you so valiantly were in for so long? How do you want to take your core group of Democrats to fight this invading horde from the GOP?
Well, first of all, I think we have to understand that we're here to represent North Carolinians. So we're not here to lay down or make buddies with people because they are in the majority right now. But we're here, and we were sent here by our constituents to do what's in their best interest. And so all of these items we're talking about that aren't in the best interest of our constituents, of their children, of their grandchildren, of the future, we're going to oppose and give an alternate vision, not just oppose them, but give an alternate vision. You know, it's important for us to emphasize to the people of North Carolina that because of their investment in the future, because of their commitment to the future, we are where we are today. 10 years ago, today was the future. We took the steps and made the sacrifices as a society, as a state, as a collective, to ensure we had what we have today. Now, the Republicans' formula is quite simple, and it is cut up the investments the state has, these assets we now have, cut them up, sell them off to their friends, and then charge the state for their friends to have a monopoly over them and sell those services and those necessities back to the state. It's a real simple formula. It'll balance the budget today, and it'll leave us bankrupt tomorrow. And that's what they want to do, because we will then be subject to them and their cronies, who will now own the state. They'll own the university system. They'll own the transportation systems. They'll own Charlotte Regional Airport and all the contracts and construction and development that is tied there too. And so you see the plan that is out there, and it's very clear.
Well, you know, there's two things you brought up, and you had mentioned this last week at the banquet. One, about the schools, how they were determined to make sure that they went through with the taking over the hospitals, I should say, where you said that they were planning on taking over the hospitals, having the hospitals be absorbed into the larger hospital systems, and then have them just dropped out. But see, the question I have here, how are they explaining to their constituents not taking Obamacare when the people in Arizona, the governor of Arizona, Florida, Ohio, they have all taken Obamacare, the Affordable Health Care Act? How can they tell their people we can afford to pay for people that come into the emergency room that now cost the people that have insurance more money? I mean, how do they get around doing that?
Well, I think you bring right back the mantra of Edgar Starnes, the majority leader there, who says we got elected, we're going to do what we want to do, we don't care what the people say, and we're not going to apologize. And so we're down to number three. We don't care what the people say. So right. He and his ilk believe that they are empowered now to do whatever they want to do. The best interest of the people, the 500,000 North Carolinians that would have received health care, that won't receive it had they expanded the Medicare system, the Medicaid system, the 27,000 jobs that would have been generated, they don't care that those 27,000 families won't have jobs now, and they're not going to apologize about it. They're going to do what they want to do, which is to not create them. And so that mindset is very much in play. It is very much in charge here, and they're trying to one-up each other with some of the ridiculous things they're putting forward in this session. And remember, just by not expanding our Medicaid system. By not expanding it in North Carolina, we know based on the studies that approximately 3,000 North Carolinians are going to die because of that lack of medical care. We know we're going to pay almost $2 billion in uncompensated and indigent care for our hospitals. What's going to happen in the rural areas? Those smaller hospitals are going to close. Rural North Carolinians are not going to have health care available. And in those critical moments after critical injuries, when you need to get to a medical facility close by, those are some of the people who are going to die because of these decisions that we're making now. And they said, we won the election. We're going to do what we want to do. We don't care what the citizens want. And we're not going to apologize. They're not going to apologize for these folks whose families will be devastated by these 3,000 North Carolinians this coming physical year and the next physical year and the next physical year, who will die needlessly because they decided they were not going to expand Medicare and Medicaid, and they would just go ahead and push back as opposed to, as you said, what Arizona did and Florida did and Illinois and Ohio, all of the other states who made that bluff but have now taken the opportunity to expand health care to their citizens.
And you, but, you know, the thing is that there are approximately, I guess it's 30% minority in North Carolina. Is that about the close? The voting population is about 30%?
The population, if you include all immigrants, you're approaching that percentage. Yes, sir.
Well, you know, this is the thing. So most of their people are the ones that are going to die. So,
you said it. If you look at the actuarial tables, if you look at the locations of North Carolina where these rural hospitals are going to close and who is receiving these benefits or would receive them, and the senior citizens who are involved who will be deprived of these benefits, you made a very true statement. As a matter of fact, this is the first session of the General Assembly where the majority of the representatives, keeping in mind that Republicans drew these districts, and it's really ironic, the majority of the representatives are from metropolitan areas, and, of course, the majority are Republicans. So you have these Republicans voting to irreparably harm these rural districts that are, again, majority white districts,
right,
that are in and of the ones losing these hospitals, losing these opportunities for these jobs, and in which these people are going to die. And so, again, folks voted against their interests, and hopefully they're going to wake up and see that they made a mistake and they need to change what they've done. Because obviously, Edgar Starnes has said it correctly, they're not going to change what they're doing. They're going to do what they want to do. They don't care what the people say, and they're not going to apologize. So the only thing they can do is go to the ballot box and make a change.
Well, you know, and the thing is that it's been said, and it's maybe 1 or 2 years off, but in 2026, this will be a majority country. So,
well,
when the districts are being redrawn, they're going to be out of the job. They're not going to be there.
Well, I think you said it, and the strategy that appears to be in force and in place now is to create whatever economic and educational advantages they can make to deprive the emerging majority of the benefits of living in a free democracy. And so you see trying to take away the vote, trying to take away education, trying to take away opportunity and job training, trying to take away the ability to start and run businesses. You see that effort to create some type of advantage, and I believe, as you said, they recognize that they will be in the minority in years to come, and the policies they're putting in place are ones to discriminate against, oppose, and oppress the emerging majority. And it's just pretty simple on the face of the policies.
Well, you know, there's also been a policy, though, in the past, but they've been waging this ever since, the Reagan years. Every time they're in power, they, I don't know if you want rollback time or, set up landmines, whatever you want to how you want to term it, so that they roll things back so far that when the other party comes back into power, they have to spend their entire term just getting back up to zero. And they never get on any of their policies. And if you remember, like, the Clinton years were largely simply trying to roll back or rectify the changes that the Reagan-Bush years brought and fix the economy.
Well,
and then here's Obama doing nothing but fixing the devastation of the W years and the economic pit he put us in.
Well, I think that strategy will continue as they go forward. And as I said, even though in less than 10 years' time, they will no longer be in power, they're trying to build in this advantage to ensure that they will still be able to have dominion over, superiority over. And, it's, again, it's not about bringing North Carolina along or bringing us, giving us all an opportunity or having anything collectively for the future generations. It's all about what they can get and keep for themselves and at the expense of the citizens of North Carolina.
Well, you know, and I know you don't have much time, but I just like to ask you one more last question. Is, can you give us, the audience, just some dots, talking points on what their plan is so we now can look for it? What are some of the things that they are doing right now that we need to be aware of?
Well, first of all, in education, they're going to try to create an education system that will eliminate public employees, reducing the benefits, making the working conditions in public education so difficult that those who believe in public education will not participate as employees or professionals and thereby bankrupting our public education system. They're withdrawing funding, making it virtually impossible for people to have decent working conditions and taking away any expectation of permanency or reliability in the workforce and education. They want to pass a constitutional amendment to prohibit unions in North Carolina and prohibit people from participating in North Carolina in any kind of organized labor organization so that they can have safe workplaces or have decent working conditions. So that's two things they're doing right now. We've seen the war on women to try to create a hostile environment for women in healthcare and take away healthcare for women when they want to make their choices. That is coming as well, so look for a constitutional amendment on that. And all of these are generated so that you will have two North Carolinas, one that has access to education through private means and tax deductions and et cetera, and, of course, a tax deduction only does you good if you have revenue. And then the other North Carolina, it is basically a new caste system that's been created, one step above slavery, one step above what they would call slave wages, but only one step above. No enforcement of safety in the workplace, and, again, no opportunity for workers to organize and speak out to protect themselves.
Well,
I think it's important what you just said to repeat to people. They need to look it up on their own, but I think they are creating a caste system here, just like that used to exist, and you need to beware of that because it's just an economic or socioeconomic form of slavery. It is, and it just divides people and holds them down.
I'd like you to give us your contact information. How? Where on the web can they look for your webpage in the House? What is that information?
Okay. First of all, go to the North Carolina House of Representatives website or legislative website, ncleg.net, and that's a very user-friendly homepage. You will be able to type in my name or just look up Democrats or anyone else. And what I would also encourage them is when you go to ncleg.net, it will give you a member lookup, and you will have a sliding menu of all the members, both Senate and House, and you can look up who you want and click on their page. The other thing it allows you to do is
can you tell how they voted on that page?
on that page, you will see all the bills as well as how they voted on the bills. On that page, it will have an election across the menu bar that says legislation. You can search legislation by name or by topic and pull up the bill and see exactly how people voted on the bill, on any motions on the bill, and on the final bill. You'll also be able to tell who submitted it and who supported it by signing on to it. The other great thing about that web page is you can listen to the audio of the major finance committee meetings and the major appropriations committee meetings, as well as press conferences and any debates on the floor of the House or the Senate. And this is live streamed on the Internet, so you get it live.
What is your contact phone number that people can call your office in Raleigh?
Area code 919-733-5872. 919-733-5872.
And can people, if they want, they can come up and meet you and sit down and talk to you and tell you what's going on in their part of the state, the 29th district at all?
They can call, they can write. We represent all North Carolinians. We're a collective body of legislators. We work for them, and they need to make sure none of their representatives forget that. We work for the people. The people don't work for us. Contrary to what Edgar Starnes said about we do what we want to do, that's not how this government is really supposed to be set up. So, yes, come to Raleigh. If you come to Raleigh, I welcome you. Come see me. If I can help you in any way or any other Democratic member can help you, please let us know.
I want to thank you. This has been Larry Dwight Hall, who is the majority leader for the Democratic Party of the North Carolina House of Representatives. And I just want to thank you, and I hope you can come back on when I give you a call and give us some updates of what's going on up there.
Okay, well, we look forward to it and hope to send you some email updates as well that you can share with your listening audience. Appreciate the great job y'all are doing. This is what makes America great, exchanging ideas and letting people be heard and ask their questions and have a response. So thank you so much for all you do.
Well, you know, one other question I'm going to ask you, how many more Democratic representatives do we need to take over the House? How short are we?
Well, you figure you're 22, 23 short. So, and you always figure that you have to have some extra members in case you get into a situation like we had the session before last, where we have some members who decide they can't determine whether they're Republican or Democratic and, of course, desert us and join the other side. So we need what we call a working margin. So we have 43. It'd be nice if we got 20 or 23 more seats and we had 66 so that we would have a working margin just in case those emergencies came up.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Representative Larry Hall. Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll see you when you come to Raleigh. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And it's always a shame we can't get it through a single show without hearing about Larry Kissel. You know, it's kind of
No, he's in the federal side.
Listen.
This man is the majority leader of the House.
But still, the point is valid. Democrats can't decide if they're. So listen, this
yes.
is so important.
Yes.
I really want to stress this again.
Yes.
So we started this out talking about this foolish right-wing war.
We're not finished with that. We're not finished.
Now, there's Stephen Moore, you know, and Rush Limbaugh and all that. Those are just, you know,
fools.
Yeah, they are. They're just mouthpieces. You know, there's always a reason for science. Science is important and all, but
no, science is not important. What do you mean science is important? Are you kidding me? You think that flood happened by accident? That was climate change. Guy says that.
Guy said that too this week. I remember, you know, we don't, you know, climate change doesn't exist. We had the Noah's Ark. You know, it's okay. I think it's very important for people to remember. And not to put, you know, too blunt a point on it here and all, but science and free thought are the
free thought?
Well, you know, the freedom to think. And,
These are
simply bedrock, foundational movements in human history. That's why they were so important. That's why the Age of Enlightenment occurred. You know, it was the scientific revolution and the freedom of thought that it brought to be able to investigate and prove or disprove things through experimentation and not just by tradition, you know, just because the church told you so or just because the elders of the village tell you so, you know, doesn't make it true. And people need to really pay attention to this because there is a distinct war that's been going on for quite a while. It happens in every society. We happen to be going through a phase right now, but keep in mind that it's been going on for centuries. Every time a dictator gets in power, the first thing they have to do is squash thought, squash thought, and any kind of advancement that could give society a edge, like science. So there's always these, you know, you think of, you know, Mao, Chairman Mao, when he did his cultural revolution, he took all the teachers out and everything, killed them all on the streets, you know, humiliated them, killed all the scientists, all that sounds, you know, so we can't have these people thinking for themselves, you know. Stalin did the same thing. You know, Hitler did the same thing. I mean, why do you think, you know, people always say, oh, Albert Einstein, he's popular, let's put him on a T-shirt. Now, you forget the fact that the Nazis were trying to exterminate these type of people, and we got them because they fled Germany and came to a land where we accepted and embraced science and free thought. And we said, hey, we can use your brain power. Come over here.
Until Ron Paul.
You know? Yeah, these guys now, these guys now, they want to end all this. They want to cut funding for all of it.
They don't want free thought.
And
that's
because
why you have
it endangers them. See,
that's
it endangers them.
That's why you have Rush Limbaugh.
It scares them.
As a matter of fact, let me just play you, because, hey, you know, nobody knows the climate like Rush knows the climate.
Rush. From the Discovery Channel, climate change could one day affect the cost and quality of dishes traditionally served for Thanksgiving Day dinner, suggests a recent paper in the journal Food Research International. Pasty, dry turkey meat, along with expensive fruits, vegetables, and potatoes could be on the horizon if more variable extremes in regional weather patterns continue as a likely result of the fraud of climate change, indicates the author Neville Gregory. Well, we do know that thanks to putting ethanol in the gasoline, turkeys will cost more, as well as corn, maize, popcorn. By the way, Obama pardoned the turkey today. And he had the little girls out, these two daughters are out there, and they pardoned the Thanksgiving turkey. No word on whether or not the turkey pardoned Obama. Now, the usual star of the Thanksgiving Day feast is roast turkey, and according to this nutcase, it could suffer in quality as a result of climate change. Climate change could affect meat quality in two ways, said Neville Gregory, a professor in animal welfare physiology at the University of London's Royal Veterinary College. So here we've got a guy who teaches people how to be vets at an animal welfare physiology class talking to us about climate change, how it's going to screw up turkeys. He said, first, there are the direct effects on organ and muscle metabolism during heat exposure, which can persist after slaughter. So we slaughter the turkeys, but because of climate change, global warming, and all this heat, organ and muscle metabolism will continue. And take what was a juicy bird, make it dry and pasty. Prior studies. Yes, people have been studying this. Prior studies have demonstrated that heat stress can increase the risks of what's known as pale, soft, exudative meat. According to Purdue University animal scientists, pale, soft, exudative meat, PSE, is characterized by its pale color, lack of firmness, and fluid dripping from its cut surfaces. When cooked, the meat lacks the juiciness of normal meat. All of this on the horizon due to the fraud of climate change. As a second climate change impact, said Neville Gregory, changes in livestock and poultry management practices in response to hazards that stem from climate change could indirectly lead to changes in meat quality. I'm not kidding you. I'm not making it on Thanksgiving Eve. Here comes a big story from the Discovering Channel on how climate change will destroy Thanksgiving meat.
Now, class, everybody needs, you have all the information you need to know about climate change and about food study because you got it from Professor Limbaugh. And you know, no one got to be 350 pounds by eating just straw.
Yeah.
If he put your hand, if you put your hand in front of him, he would eat it.
Well, I know that, like, you know, Limbaugh probably based his turkey in oxycontin.
Oh yeah, well he pats it and he crushes it and he puts it and he when it's
like
dried chicken he it's all instead of flour he uses oxycontin
broken down
and grinds up to a powder.
But when someone points out that, you know, food is actually being affected, you know, that he's trying to
food would not be affected by climate change.
I know.
Now, this is completely moronic.
Yes.
How is that possible?
But
if you have a dry, I mean, I look at my flowers out here, and I don't have my flowers in yet. Matter of fact, my lawn man says, well, where's your flowers? I didn't get them yet, so I'm getting them next week. But the thing is that if it doesn't get water, they dry up and die. My, what do you call those things? The bushes over there didn't bloom yet because we had that cold spell in March. Things in the Africa would you do? Anyway, I got red and blue.
If you follow science, these people don't follow science. See, if you go out and
science is garbage. There's stuff in the climate change.
All of your plants would be fine if you would just sprinkle fairy dust on it or pray. Or
fairy dust. Now, wait a minute.
That would make
wait a minute.
Yeah.
Let's don't get into fairy dust.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Well,
okay. Now, all I'm saying is that
we're talking about energy quality later.
How can you not believe in climate change? Now, the thing is, the whole world, has evolved over the billions of years. I'm sorry, Rush. I know you believe it's only 6,000. Since the billions of years this planet has cooled off from a hot, burning cinder to where we are now, things have grown. But some of the things that you grow in this state, like we call those dogwoods, you can't grow in Alaska. As a matter of fact, when I first moved down here to Charlotte, my mother came up from Orangeburg, South Carolina, when she moved down there about 10 years before when she retired from New York City. She dug up, we helped her dig up, she took 10 dogwoods and took them down to Orangeburg with them. They lived exactly 6 months. Why? Because it's too daggone hot down there. And they don't get the rain we do. You know, you can drive from North Carolina, and as soon as you don't even have to know when you cross the border when you're in South Carolina. You know why?
Why?
The trees are brown. The leaves are brown. And this is the summertime, even in the winter. We have green almost all year round in this part of North Carolina where I live. But in South Carolina, forget it, case closed. You go across the border, you can tell. So you can't grow certain things in certain areas. And if he can't believe that the turkey won't be as good, because that will prove that climate change.
Yeah, they know. They
is ignorant. He's ignorant.
It is. It's ignorant. It's this weird superstition and this weird. I mean, you know, there was a joke floating around that meme a while back of you know, the you remember the flood is 6,000 years ago the Earth was formed. And yet, you know, we have historically, I mean, the Sumerians were already doing science and technology 6,000 years ago, you know. So it's kind of a, these jokes write themselves, but these people, they'll say or do anything. But I urge people, real quick, just want to point it out before, I've said it before, but go and get a copy of this book and read it. Wrote it a long time ago during W's term, but it's an absolutely brilliant book. It's been revised and updated since.
You wrote it?
But it's called, no, I did not.
Oh.
It's The Republican War on Science,
right,
by Chris Mooney.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
and it
documents
all of what they were doing because they had a sustained across-the-board assault on science. And see, people got to remember, this is very important. It's been going on for a while, just like I pointed out. You know, you can take modern examples of Mao and Stalin and Hitler and all. They always destroy education and science first because you can't have people who think for themselves in your population or else they'll counter you. So you take the intellectuals out, and then you can move on to the cattle and herd everybody around. But they have been at a sustained war, and people shouldn't forget that we used to be one of those enlightened nations. We were founded on the vision of enlightenment. You know, Ben Franklin, all of these founding fathers, you remember, they were Renaissance men. They believed, like Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, everything, you're supposed to be well-rounded. You know, you're supposed to know how to build your house and plant your crops and study astronomy and read all of literature and, orate as great as, Cicero or Caesar or someone. You were supposed to be well-rounded in arts, music, science, everything. This was going to be the enlightened nation, the beacon of light on the earth, and we did for a while. I mean, look at what our past century was producing. We were coming out with all of these great inventors. I mean, we produced the Edison. We changed the world. That was because we were actively investing in our education and our sciences.
And what did FDR...
Let me warn you, and let me warn the nation against the smooth evasion that says, of course we believe these things, but we do not like the way the present administration is doing them. Just turn them over to us. We will do all of them. We will do more of them. We will do them better. And most important of all, the doing of them will not cost anybody anything.
Cost anybody anything, which is absolutely true. But so get back my point. You know, even Republicans used to love science.
Well, they never had done everything with science before we started.
Well, here's one of the things, though. There was a coupling effect, something that happened. During the World War, we had to focus our time on winning the war. So we narrowed the field, if you will, of what we could invest in, and we invested heavily in war research. You know, remember we confiscated the industries. We did, we took over factories. We did everything. We said, hey, we need you to build, tanks and airplanes and this and that. Well, the same thing happened with science. We said, we need y'all to build us better weapons. You know, we need y'all to find a better way to, make the rifle, a better way to build an airplane, a better way to, can we go super science? Can we shoot missiles? Can we shoot radar? This was serious business because at stage one, the entire world war and the outcome, if we could beat Nazism or whatever. And then came after the war, the politicization. And this is what, Eisenhower and the rest were warning about. Remember when they left office, they were great. The military-industrial complex. If you don't dismantle it after the war, it will remain sharply focused on this one thing and eat away the rest of the economy and the rest of education and the rest of society. And it's done that, unfortunately, because the Republicans, in their weird way, they only want to be present in war. you know, they won't have no tax cuts on war, no defunding of war, no nothing like that. Keep all of that intact. But let's get rid of social programs. Let's get rid of health care. Let's get rid of education. Let's get, you know, poor people, throw them under the bus. But the problem becomes that science, you know, a good example of this is in the universities. During the war and after the war, the money went into science that helped the military. You know, they funded it. So they would get the huge, huge buildings. Like on my campus, where I went to school, they built this massive, multi-billion-dollar, you know, polymer science technology building.
So that was all this other stuff. That was
and, but look, all of your all of your regular programs, you know, your English, your music, arts, you know, any of the humanities, they get no money. They get nothing. They just get sidelined. And things get more and more specialized toward military-style science. But when you keep cutting the budgets everywhere and you end up with nothing left but, you know, a few airplanes and tanks that function, your society as a whole falls apart. And I think that's what we need to remember. I mean, there was a reason why we went through entire generations of fantastic thinkers, you know, while we were just churning out these Edisons and Teslas and, you know, even picking up people like fleeing across the world, like Einstein, just to come to America. You know? And then now, I mean, what they want.
But well, we also.
Now we don't even really think.
We also picked up W. Yeah, and we picked up Rand Paul.
Well, that is one of the problems. Yeah, that is one of the huge problems.
You know, it's like when you cast a net out and you're fishing, mm-hmm. you get some crabs in there.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking for a tuna. You got some crabs in there.
Right.
You know, you have some mullet. You know, you have some of those little skinny fish.
There's an
you save them or you throw them back.
It's an interesting thing though. We're doing this brutal assault on education. And on learning, and you're going to reap the rewards.
Right.
Like there was 40, 50 years ago, there was a group that came out of the Goldwater campaign, and a bunch of Republicans, but they were the thinking Republicans, and they issued a warning then. This is way in that war, the Republican War on Science, I was talking about.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, he says, remember, 1966, group of Republicans came out, they left, and out of Harvard, by the way. But they left the party, and they published a book called "The Party That Lost Its Head," and it was a warning. They left because of Goldwater, and they said they were brutalizing science and intelligence, and they warned. They gave a stark warning to the future that said if they continued to do this, they were usurping reality. And they were going to end up with alienating all intellectuals, destroying the intellectual base of America, destroying our culture, and ending up with just an empty shell of America with no promise of a future, no developmental ability. And they said they ended the book with, at the time, Ronald Reagan was being chosen. And they said this is the final steps being taken, that they were going to replace reality with the fated world of the Class B movie and pretend to have excellence instead of having excellence.
Well, and that's come to pass.
No, it has come. And that's what I'm saying.
In North Carolina here, we were third as the leading education system in the country.
Yep.
We're now 47th. And this occurred within 2 years.
Right. Because of this crippling of the education and everything else budgets. They've destroyed them. So it's the same thing, look, happened a few years ago in California. You remember California used to have some of the best schools in the country, some of the best industry. They went in, they changed the law there, and they actually changed the state, which they're doing here. We just talked about that with our fantastic representative. They put in an amendment there that you could never raise taxes without a two-thirds majority of the entire state voting on it. So they haven't raised any taxes since, and they've had to continually fight devastating budget pitfalls. You know, they've had a busted economy ever since.
Well,
they got the highest taxes in the country.
But they don't have the highest taxes.
No, they don't. But what they did.
Jersey does.
The same thing happened. Their public education system fell from number one in the nation down to, and, you know, it's horrible now because there's no money. And it's just simple.
Well, why do you need money?
What they do is that self-fulfilling prophecy. They say public education is horrible because, you know, it has things like, you know, black people in it and, you know, and intellectual thought. You know, you don't want any kind of liberal exposure at anything. But they go in, defund it all, and then say, hey, look, public education isn't working. We need private education. We need more church schools and more business schools. And, hey, guess what? If you pay me a lot of money and divert some tax dollars to me, I'll set up a school and run it for profit. And it's like, oh, okay, but there's an answer for you. I think it's a travesty. Again, they've privatized something that is a public trust. And the end result is not the profit of society. It's the profit of a few individuals while all of society suffers.
Well, the thing is, we didn't really divert, but I just want to get back to this war on science. And there's a of course it is.
Yeah.
But for conservative media like Moore and Limbaugh, scientific ignorance is a feature, not a glitch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from climate, according to the article here, from climate science and polar bears to economics to condoms to social sciences, conservative media peddle the same anti-science behavior over and over and over again. The logic that scientists are inherently biased because they care about science is third rate. Well, I was listening to, and I love this show, Coast to Coast. It comes on every night here, 1 o'clock in the morning. I love it. I loved it when they had their original host on.
Why do you love that? It's kind of crazy.
It's because, you know, you get these people talking about Bigfoot and the aliens come and take it. But, you know, when they go off and they get these guys like Alex Jones on there.
If I want to know about Bigfoot and aliens.
Yeah.
I watch the History Channel.
Oh,
that's
right.
That's what it's for.
That's right.
Goal.
That's true. That's true.
I mean,
you're
when it's
absolutely
not
true.
Logging in Alaska. I'm saying.
I'm sure Sarah Palin has seen him. But the thing is, she's married to a Bigfoot. But anyway, the thing is that
I can see Sasquatch from my front door.
Right. I see him every night. He comes and eats the flowers. The thing is that these other people, none of them have scientific know-how, but they talk to you about. Now, I worked in the weather field. I worked in that. I have seen the aerial and space photos of how greenhouse gases have affected the planet, how the ozone is polluted with the burning of the South American jungles to make mines, how they burnt away this planet. There's a new series coming on called Under the Dome.
Yeah.
Somehow there's a dome placed over, I don't know, an entire city or village or something, mm-hmm. and people can't get out. And you know, this is what these people are doing. This is what these conservative people are doing. They're putting as many people under this dome to keep them ignorant of the fact that there's anybody else. Now, there's a movie coming out.
Ignorant of the fact that there's reality.
There's a movie coming out with Tom Cruise and Morgan Freeman called Oblivion, where I haven't seen it yet, but because it's not out yet, but where the people on Earth, there's not supposed to be anybody on Earth. We had gone to another asteroid. We went to another planet. I don't know where the heck we're at. But Tom Cruise finds out the reality that all people left on the planet. And Morgan Freeman might be the head of it. I don't know. But anyway, it's almost like the movie The Matrix. I would think from the commercial short details I've seen, it reminds me something like The Matrix. But anyway, these people have been brainwashed for so long
by Fox,
that's not
Limbaugh, by O'Reilly, by that fool Hannity. None of these people have been in the military, but they talk to you like they were veterans with Bronze Stars. That's what they talk to you about. When they talk about climate change, they never have a scientist on. They have, they were speaking about climate change the other day. They were talking about science the other day, and they had that fool Levine on, Mark Levine. What the hell is he? All he knows is he looks at the weather channel or goes out to the door and says, is it raining out? I mean, is it wet? He can see it's raining, but he don't know if he's going to get wet. These people, it drives me crazy from a point that I spent 20 years or so in working for the Weather Service, knowing what happened.
The difference between knowing and not knowing. That's the difference between science and BS that they propagate.
And then they had this guy, Brad Blankman, who's a denier of science.
Well, see, this is a perfect example. I saw this in your research data here, and this is I want you to point this out because this is what they're trying to do now. The science just blather. You know, that didn't work out too well. So now they tried to come up with, you know, just like they have these fake organizations, you know, so that they can sound like they have, you know, something backing them up. But now they've just come out with fake data.
Oh, well,
exactly,
of course.
What
this Blakeman, I mean, he comes on and says, well, for every one scientist that says there is climate change, I'll give you 10 scientists that said there's not. That's a lie. He can't get 10 to 1 saying that.
No, it's
the opposite. It's not even the opposite.
No,
it's less than that.
Yeah, it's like 2% or something of any time. 97%.
97% of the scientists or more say that there is climate change. And
right.
They
all 100% say there's climate change. 97-98% say it's human caused.
Right.
And 2% say there's still, maybe it's still more planetary change.
Right.
But they've all 100% say climate change. But these fools, A, still deny climate change to begin with.
Well,
and on top of that, when they try to make up stats, they just come up with this crap.
Well,
like this, 10 to 1, all scientists.
The thing is that they're claiming that it's such a fake that we changed the name to climate change instead of global warming. We didn't change that name. They changed the name.
They changed
the name to global warming.
I don't care what you want to call it.
I mean, it is. And then Russ Limbaugh says, well, you see, look at all those major snowstorms we have out here. How can it be getting warm? See, he doesn't understand.
Well,
in order for us to have snow, we have to have an air that has moisture in it.
Yeah.
The warmer the air is, the more moisture in the air.
Which is also the same reason on the tropical side of things, you get more storms.
Right.
And in the north, you're going to get more snow.
And the thing is that you don't have to have 100 more storms.
Right.
You're going to get 10 storms that are worse than 100 storms.
Yes. That's just exactly why we got hurricane hitting New York.
Right.
Okay. You know, let's not make an Al Gore movie out of it. I'm just saying. The truth is pretty clear, and these people simply lie. They can't even back up their stuff, and they just outright lie. And that's what's sad is that people who watch Fox News know, I don't know what they think, but they're not even getting.
But it's because they're being brainwashed.
Yeah, they are.
And see, here's the thing. When you they're being paid by the oil companies.
Mm-hmm.
They're being paid by the oil companies because burning fossil fuels adds this carbon dioxide in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And these people don't know the difference between carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. They don't understand the difference. They think they can breathe both of them. And
well,
you can't.
Look, this is the thing that I've said for years. This one's cracks me up. They think that there's no connection between, you know, you can go to L.A. Basin. You know, there were some fantastic pictures a while back. They have recently set up some of the astronomy telescopes that we use to ring the mountains there around L.A. that we look at the stars, you know, with. Well, they recently have turned them down and trained them on the cities. And they're using them for atmospheric studies because, you know, they're so sensitive that they can study the elements that are in stars and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they use them to, you know, look at space clouds and whatnot and see what's in the, you know, what's in nebula, stuff like that. But they've turned them onto our own cities, and they can determine, you know, how much exhaust is in the air, what kind, what chemicals are there, why we have smog, what's the constituents, you know, what's going on. If you look at any major city with that huge, giant, gray mass of smog, you know, where do they think it comes from? I mean, that's what I can't understand. And this whole thing about, they say, I've heard before them saying that carbon monoxide, it doesn't do anything. And they say it's natural, it's in the air anyway, it doesn't hurt anybody. All I got to say, look, why do you think people take hoses from the rear end of their car and put it in the window of their car to kill themselves, right?
Well, now
if it's not, look, if they're going to get into this whole thing, I want them to live on a house.
Well, you see, now wait a minute, you're getting a little off subject because that's carbon monoxide.
I understand.
Carbon dioxide. Is we have this whole atmosphere has carbon dioxide in it, and before you go in,
yeah, but there's a balance.
There is a
right?
balance, right? Absolutely.
It's all about percentages.
And let me just play this little bit to this fool, Joe Barton. Oh, another miserable fool. Listen to this.
I think it is a tragedy of the first proportion that a private corporation can be subjected to what I would characterizes a shakedown, in this case a $20 billion shakedown. I apologize.
Now, this is a man who was apologizing to BP.
Right.
He apologized to BP for the for their oil spill. This guy's name is Joe Linus Barton. He is the Republican from none other than Texas, from the 6th Congressional District, and as a Tea Party caucus member, this fool is the chair of the subcommittee when it comes to science. And he said on June 17th, he accused the White House of a $20 billion shakedown of BP. After the company reached an agreement with Obama. Now, why? Well, what's the shakedown? What's the shakedown? Obama, they agreed with Obama to establish an escrow account to pay claims of the people harmed by the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. He made the accusation at the outset of the House hearing where BP chief Tony Hayward appeared for the first time in Congress. Facing Hayward, at the witness table, Barton said, I apologize, as you just heard.
Right.
Anytime a citizen or a corporation does something that is legitimately wrong, is subject to some sort of political pressure, that is, again, in my words, amounts to a shakedown. What? They did something wrong.
Right.
So what's the shakedown? Prior to the establishment of the agreement, the Obama administration had been public in their criticism of BP for the oil spill. Barton and other critics accused White House of attempting to deflect criticism on how they handled the situation, which made it more difficult for BP to raise short-term funds in capital markets for their operations. Barton's remarks were widely criticized by the White House spokesman, Robbie Gibbs, Vice President Joe Biden, GOP congressional leadership, and fellow Republicans, some whom called on Barton to relinquish his leadership role in the House Energy Subcommittee. Barton later said that his earlier remarks had been misconstrued.
Yeah,
and that he believed BP was responsible for the accident. Later that day, he issued a statement apologizing for using the term shakedown and fully respected his apology to BP. Now, here's a man that his own constituents said, you are a complete fool.
Right.
Hey, well, what, are you kidding me?
Yeah, but again, this is the thing that bothers me, the hypocrisy of the Republicans. They're calling a shakedown because you're making a company that did something disastrous. And I mean, the word disaster was the term. They affected hundreds of millions of people across an entire continent, dozens of nations, dozens of our states. They destroy trillions of dollars in industry and business with all the beaches that were closed, all the shrimping, all the fishing, all the boating, all the tourism that was destroyed. You know, across the board, they caused all the damage, so they got a minuscule penalty for that, which he is screaming about. Okay, they're screaming about that. Remember, look.
They don't like it, take it out of his pocket. He probably had it in his pocket.
Yeah, you want to know who had it in his pocket? Cheney. We talked about this back a couple weeks ago, but for instance, Cheney's own personal company, his own company, which he gave all those no-bid contracts to in Iraq, made $40 billion just on the books going into Iraq. That's the business he gave them officially, $40 billion. You know, you talk about a shakedown. A guy who starts a war illegally gives his own company $40 billion? Are you kidding me?
Well,
but, you know, there was no outrage there.
Well,
there's outrage over the whole Gulf of Mexico.
And I don't want us to miss the point about Mr. Bart. He worked just before he went to Congress for Atlantic Richfield Oil Company gas.
Right. So, as an oil guy telling you that, you know, the shakedown is when oil companies.
It was our fault that we didn't help them.
Yeah.
That is their problem. They're supposed to help themselves.
Yeah. So look,
and before we get on, we have someone on the phone right here. And who might this be? Hello?
Hello?
Yes? Can you hear us?
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Lawson.
Good afternoon, and who might this be?
This is Ann Little from Union County.
Oh, you mean the chairperson of the Union County Democratic Party?
Yes, sir, I am the chair of the Democratic Party of Union County.
And what is going on? When is your convention?
Well, the Union County convention is on April 20th. We're going to have registration at 9 a.m. and fall at 10.
Very good. Do you have, do you know anybody guest speakers? Is going to be there or anything yet?
Well, our two speakers, one will be Dale Nelson. Dale Nelson ran for one of the very new districts, 55, that was etched out by the Republican Party, so they could get another Republican in the House. And he ran very honorably, and he did actually he did very well, just not well enough because of the numbers.
Right.
So Mr. Nelson will be speaking, and then our own Franklin Dees, who is mayor of Marshville.
Right.
And he's also written a book, and he's in the middle of another book. And he has a lot to say, and he will be speaking as well. So we have two speakers.
Mr. Dees, Mayor Dees, going to be running again for office?
No, he's not.
Oh, he's not running for office again?
No, he's not running for treasurer again.
No, I'm talking about for mayor.
Oh, for mayor. Well, we're encouraging him to do so, and Mayor Dees is probably under advisement with his family and a couple of other things because Mr. Dees, right now, he has a tax preparation service,
has
four or five offices in South Carolina, Charlotte, Marshville, and in Monroe, and so he's very busy right now, and of course, he's running the city, so I don't know if he's going to run again. I would hope that he would, because when the bypass comes through, it's going to end there in Marshville, and that will... we'll need someone strong and someone who's really community-minded to make sure that Marshville does not become a carpet-bagging area for marketeers.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Marshville also includes a very famous college, Wingate College, right?
Yeah. No, that's in Wingate. That's right next door.
That's next door. What's the college it has up there in near Marshville?
It's in Wingate, and then if you go a little further east, there's Marshville.
Marshville, and, okay.
Marshville has done wonderful under his leadership, and I expect Should he stay, that it will do even just as well with the onslaught of what they're about to do. Hotels have already contacted that city and a lot of other things, because people who are analysts about growth in cities know that if truckers and people who are traveling to the beach or whatever, if they're going to take the toll road, which I believe it will be a toll road, the bypass, it's going to go from Charlotte to Marshville. And it'll end in Marshville, and people might want to spend the night there. And so that city has to sort of brace itself for the onslaught of travelers coming through. So it should be an exciting time for Marshville.
Very good. Well, I hope you can you have a great convention. Our convention is tomorrow here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And as I am the newly elected president of the North Carolina Diabetes Caucus, we're going to be heavily involved in the new Citizen Review Board. And I have a piece that I'm going to play. I did an interview with the people that are highly upset about this. And because I was on that committee when it first started, I was one of the first people that gave contributions on how it should work and whatnot. And I am at a gasp to find out how it is not working. And if you can stay on, I'd like you to listen, because do they have a citizens review board in Union County?
No, no.
I always say citizens review board. That means if the police have some sort of a problem with an accidental shooting, or civilians have a complaint, they go to the captain, or they go to somebody at the precinct and they give it to internal affairs. Is any of that, do you have anything like that where after the decision is made, there's a citizen review board that will there with them?
No, I know the citizen review. As a matter of fact, when I was a kid going to Andrew Jackson High in Queens, I did a paper on the citizen review board in New York. So I'm familiar with it, and there's nothing similar to that here. Now, when we hired, when the area of Monroe, not the county, but when the area of Monroe, the city of Monroe, hired Deborah Duncan, who's a fabulous chief of police, she did start some community, she has community policing, and that really helped. That really helped. But there's no actual review board that has any type of credibility with making decisions with the city or with the county to make sure that the citizens of the county are being treated well by law enforcement.
Well,
we don't have
if you want to listen on the computer or listen on the phone, this was a fabulous interview that I had yesterday with him, and I am going to play it right now. This is an interview I had with Matt Newton, who's an attorney of Newton and Arroyo here in Charlotte, North Carolina, and he is he's the point person on the legal side representing the citizens to the council about inquiring how this review board is working.
This is the last word with Michael Lawson. And right now we are in for a treat. We have with us a young man named Matt Newton, who is the managing partner of Newton and Arroyo.
I don't know what happened to say it over again.
This is the last word with Michael Lawson. And right now we are in for a treat. We have with us a young man named Matt Newton, who is the managing partner of Newton and Arroyo, and that is a law practice here in Charlotte, North Carolina, which practices general litigation and predominantly criminal defense, who grew up here in Charlotte and graduated from Myers Park High School at the age of 16. Boy genius. Well, I graduated when I was 17. And he graduated from college at 19. They wanted to get you out the best way possible. They said, give him a certificate, show him the door. He also is a He ran for office against Mel Watt, and that was how many years back?
A year ago.
A year ago, okay. And I am very glad to have you on the show. The last word.
It's great to be here.
What are you doing right now that you can tell everybody here, because there's a whole lot you're doing, but what are you doing right now?
The big issue I've been focusing on is organizing an effort to educate our city council on the Citizens Review Board and the changes that are necessary to make it a meaningful board, give it the power it needs to fulfill its purpose.
I remember the Citizens Review Board when it first started, because I was one of the people they called in. They called in people from all across the spectrum to sit in, just to give input to how the review board should operate, what should be some of the general rules. It was not a good thought of, it wasn't thought of very highly when it first came out. But, you know, as I always said, you know, you're not in Kansas anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This is not Mayberry.
Not Mayberry. That's right.
17th or 18th largest city in the country, and with growing pains, you must have more clarification for the people. You must have more transparency.
Mm-hmm.
And a review board, a citizen review board, is one of those transparencies. Now, I understand there's some statistics about police involvement with the citizens, and there hasn't been any real transparency for the citizens. How many complaints are we talking about?
Well, over the course of 16 years, there have been over 1,400 complaints that have been processed by Internal Affairs. Those are complaints that we know have been processed by Internal Affairs. There were
when you
a number,
say process, what do you mean process?
Where they have reviewed the complaint, right, responded with the citizen, and made a decision. There have been a number of instances that we know of right now, and I'm sure that there are many, many more within our community of Internal Affairs ignoring citizens or not returning phone calls when they're wanting to lodge complaints. And
right,
there were a number of people that were before City Council about a week and a half ago when this issue was heard that had expressed the fact that they had tried to contact Internal Affairs for over a year and had gotten no response. Thankfully, they are now in touch with Internal Affairs, but they aren't the only ones. And I think that it's symptomatic of a larger problem, and a larger problem that I hope City Council is willing to address.
Well, we say 1,400 citizen complaints or internal complaints from the police department and recommending them to Internal Affairs?
1,400 citizen complaints.
So citizens complain. Who do they complain to? They didn't go directly to Internal Affairs.
Yeah, well, they go to the police department.
They go to the police department.
Yeah,
local
to
precinct
your,
or...
Either one, a local precinct, or if you do go to the main police department downtown, they will, by and large, what they do is they refer folks to their local precincts.
Okay.
But you'll speak with the police officer within the local precinct who will take a report. Then they will send that to Internal Affairs, at which point Internal Affairs, it is their job to conduct an investigation, including speaking not just to the police officer but the citizen, and formulate a decision whether or not any disciplinary action is appropriate.
Okay, so but getting this whole scenario how it works, if you go to the precinct, you just don't speak to Joe Blow behind the desk. I mean, do you speak to the captain of the precinct, or does the captain of the precinct send you, he has his own Internal Affairs people that handles that? I mean, how is that handled? How does a person go to... from a complaint, what do they do?
Well, each police department has someone who will field the complaint,
and that's only their job.
Well, no,
okay.
No,
they don't
it's
have
a part
somebody
of their
sitting
job
in the office, Internal Affairs office, in every precinct.
Well, with Internal Affairs, the department itself within the department, that is solely their job. But
okay.
But the person that a citizen will speak to initially,
right,
is someone who was just fielding the complaint.
Okay.
And then they turn that over to Internal Affairs.
Well, how do we know that they do that?
We don't.
Okay. So there could be
4,000 of less.
Absolutely. And I guess that's the point, is that we know that there have been 1,400 considered by Internal Affairs with final decisions, and we don't know the disciplinary action, if there ever if there is a disciplinary action, what that was.
So we don't know how many complaints were actually filed. So you mean there's no computer listing, no paper trail to say, well, there was 5,000 people?
Not that I know of.
Why?
I'm on board with you with that question.
I mean,
I would like to know.
I don't understand. If you go to buy stuff in a grocery store, and now the manager of the department in that particular, because I worked in a grocery store, I know how it works. They have a manager for various departments, the canned goods department, the grocery department, they call it. If it's low, they put it down on a list. So you're telling me that I could go in and make a complaint and it might never be recorded?
Traditionally, when a complaint is made, a citizen will write that complaint on paper.
Right.
But it has been our experience, and I don't know of any number larger than the 1,400 that we know of have actually been considered by Internal Affairs. But it's been our experience, and we know of a number, and I'm sure there is a much larger population.
Of course.
But a number of folks who have filled out complaints and have never been responded to.
Okay, so when they fill out this complaint, it's given to someone behind the desk, and then that person would give it to someone within that precinct who's part of Internal Affairs?
Yes.
Okay, now, and then what does that person do who works for Internal Affairs with that piece of paper? What are they supposed to do?
As far as I know, and this is something that would be found within our police department's directives, as far as I know, it's their job to conduct an investigation at that point. I think ideally an investigation would include speaking.
All right, now I'll cut you off, because I want to make sure everybody understands how this works. The person who receives the complaint, does he just go directly to Internal Affairs, or does he go directly to Internal Affairs and CC's the captain of the precinct?
I don't believe this is a matter for the captain of the precinct necessarily, unless it's
but if it's one of
dealing
people.
With. I agree with you. I agree
mean,
with you.
You know,
I believe
unless
what happens.
Him. I mean, unless it's him. I mean, but, the protocol. I mean, I've been in the military. I mean, yeah, you got to complain about your first sergeant, and you're going to give the letter to your first sergeant, but you're also going to CC, make sure somebody else got it, too. You're not just going to give it to one person who can drop off the end of a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so to me, and that's one of the things that I want, and that's the reason why I want to take you through these step by step, because it doesn't seem like what I hear so far that we, the citizens, know how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And there should be some way that we can look online. These are the steps that you do if you want to file a complaint.
Well, I agree with you.
And
that
that's
was
not online.
No. No, I agree with you. That's something that Patrick Cannon had addressed, and also addressed the process. Well, having steps placed on the city government website for people to follow. So if you ever have an issue of trying to understand where you need to go, then you can log on to the city government website,
mm-hmm.
and you can find not just how to file a complaint with Internal Affairs, but the process thereafter, and then the process
where it's at in the tunnels. Like you go to the post office, and you can do a tracking number.
Sure.
You can find out it's in A's hands now. It's in B's hands now.
I think part of the problem is that it doesn't quite work that way.
Yeah. Right, you think?
Once it gets into the system, it's next to near impossible to find out where Internal Affairs is within the process. And like I said, there have been numerous cases where we have been told that Internal Affairs just doesn't respond to inquiries whatsoever. With two individuals that had had spoken for on city council about a week and a half ago, they had tried their best to stay on top of the complaints that they had filed and didn't have their phone calls returned. And for all they knew, the complaints had just fallen between the cracks.
Who does the internal affairs answer to?
Internal affairs answers to the police chief.
The police chief.
And then again, too, it's the police chief's final decision whether or not to recommend the disciplinary action, if at all, because we have no access to information pertaining to disciplinary action.
If internal affairs doesn't make the decision about this is the deal here.
They
don't
recommend
tell the police chief that?
The final decision is the police chief's. They recommend any disciplinary action, if at all. There's no way for us to find out what that is because it's considered confidential state personnel records. But then they will recommend that to the police chief who makes the final decision.
You know, I think that's a little... Words fail me. But and that's the reason why we need to have this all fall on the mayor's shoulder and get rid of the city council and county commission. We need to have one city council and have the mayor in charge of everything so we can hang him or her out to dry if something goes wrong. Right now, you don't know who's on first, what's on second. I don't know who's on third base. The Abbott and Costello routine all over. All right, so now we're at the point where the citizen turns it into the man behind the desk at the precinct, local precinct. He or she, in turn, passes on to
internal affairs.
Internal affairs. Maybe they give it to the captain of the precinct. Maybe. We don't know.
Who knows?
Now, the paperwork from there is in the cloud like we back up our computers now, what you're saying. We don't know where the paperwork is at. It's hidden with the internal affairs. Now, my understanding of this, hey, you know, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to watch all these TV shows. Internal affairs doesn't tell the captain jack if they're investigating one of his people. They're not supposed to anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Sometimes they don't even, and that's where you said that the captain might not know because they don't want the captain to give a heads up to anything that's going on. But sometimes they do, and maybe they do have to, but it's up to the captain of the precinct to keep it under his hat or her hat. Now, what happens once internal affairs gets it?
Well, they conduct their investigation.
Right.
And the police directives, I'm sure, have a systematic process to do that. And we have experienced with what we've been told from members of the community, we have been told that there are times that these investigations haven't included the citizens' own testimony, and then again too, there are multiple times, like I was saying, where the citizen has been excluded altogether and doesn't even know if there ever was an outcome in any of the investigatory the process or decision, but that's up to internal affairs at that point. And then once they feel like they have completed their investigation to an extent that satisfies them, they make a decision on whether or not to institute any disciplinary action on the police officer. And that decision is then handed over to the police chief, who makes the final call on whether or not they're going to institute that disciplinary action.
Will the police chief then... We're not talking about the captain of the precinct where it occurred at. We're talking about the police chief.
Mm-hmm.
Will he call in the complainantee and say, hey, we didn't find nothing? Or, hey, yes, he's going to be disciplined. I can't tell you what because it's private, and I can understand that. Will they at least do that?
I don't believe there's any requirement for that. Having said that, I would doubt that that's ever the case.
But see, then how would you know if anything was ever done? If the person behind the desk just put in the circle file under the desk when you walked out the door?
Well,
I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
From my standpoint, I would like to see more transparency for the community. How does the community know
right.
what if any disciplinary action had ever occurred?
That's right. Why go to them if they're not going to do nothing?
Absolutely.
Not that they have to do something, because the citizen could be just as wrong as hell. But at least tell them we found nothing, or we found something and it's going to be handled.
Yes, absolutely.
But
don't leave citizens hanging.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, don't let anybody hang.
What faith can our community have in a fair, safe, effective police force if there are no answers to their questions and absolutely no transparency?
Absolutely correct. Especially when a police chief runs for office. Now, not here, because he's appointed here, but the sheriff runs for office.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he does.
The DA runs for office.
Absolutely.
And if the DA isn't going to press any charges, because to me, we're going to get to the DA, so let me jump on that right away. All right, so now, because I want to talk about this DA routine here. So now it's the Internal Affairs handles the whole nine yards. They come up with a report.
Mm-hmm.
And do we know, what we have right now laid out, is there a specific time limit they're given to do certain tasks, like handing a report to the police chief?
I don't know. Once again, it's something that is controlled by the internal police directives. If there is a time frame, then it certainly isn't an expedited time frame. It's one that when you have a citizen say that they have attempted to communicate and work with Internal Affairs for over a year, I think that there is a breakdown in the system.
And we're not talking about a shooting. We're talking about the cop slapped somebody or something.
Yeah,
I mean,
simple matters.
So we're talking about simple matters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why does that take a year? And, well, I guess, you know, we want them to be thorough. So we want them to take a year. But let somebody know.
Yeah, but we do know in matters that involve shootings,
right.
That those matters don't take years.
No, that's right.
1 year, even a singular year.
Right.
And so what it amounts to is a dropping of the ball. Folks who have filed complaints and who have fallen between the cracks and who have been forgotten. I don't know if that's due to
so many complaints. Five or 6,000 maybe, and they couldn't get
potentially,
to them all.
Potentially, so maybe internal affairs, there need to be more internal affair officers.
Yeah.
These are questions that I can't answer because I don't I haven't researched that. But certainly we know that there is a problem, and it's a problem that needs to be addressed.
How many suits against the police department were filed? Average? Do we know that?
I don't know that either. Right now, I'm
you
working
mean
with
that's
the Charlotte.
Not even listed on a computer website somewhere?
No. No.
So we don't know how many.
I'll put it this way. I've worked with the Charlotte School of Law on the Citizens Review Board issue. We wanted to know who comprised the Citizens Review Board.
Right.
They had to file Freedom of Information Act requests. To get that information, and it took them over 7 months.
That's something that was changed because, see, when I was originally on it, that was not part of the thing. It was it was people. We all knew who was down there. Matter of fact, everybody's name was listed who was even sitting in the room.
Yep.
So that's changed.
Other cities, they have specific websites for their Citizens Review Board.
Absolutely.
We know here in Charlotte, we have a website for our city government. We have the names and pictures and bios of every member of city council.
Right.
It wouldn't be too expensive, cumbersome, or burdensome to create an additional page.
My grandson could do it.
We're talking about
rocket science here. So it's not the idea of cost effectiveness that we're talking about here.
No, absolutely not. None of this is. A redrafting of the ordinance, this is nothing
that is...
Why would
they have to redraft the ordinance to put down the Citizen Review Board members?
Oh,
I
agree with you.
It has nothing to do with the ordinance. Is it listed anywhere in city government that there is a
Review board. Within our municipal code, it is.
Wait a minute. Municipal code is one thing. In the city government agency listing of all the agencies, is it listed?
It is listed. It's listed
and
on the website.
Blank.
But it just says that they review internal affair complaints. It doesn't have any information pertaining to any complaints that are before the board or any information pertaining to anyone who comprises the board. And I think that we need to have that transparency.
Ugh. I mean, give me a break. This is just complete nonsense. I mean, because it could be members of every one of them could be a member of a policeman's family. Or the governor's family, or the mayor's family, or the the police chief's family.
Now, I'm not indicting anyone.
No, I'm not
here.
Indicting.
I, yeah.
But we're talking about transparency here.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're talking about transparency. At least that. We're not saying let's get in there and make the decisions with the internal affairs.
Mm-hmm. No. No, they still can make their decisions.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's their job. I mean, we don't want their job.
No.
But their job should be they need to inform a citizen who makes a complaint that your complaint is under study. It's being worked on right now.
And where it is. Where it is in that process.
We are. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, no, that might not even be that I even asked them for that. I would ask them to say, we are investigating it and we will apprise you of when we start approaching the end.
Mm-hmm.
Even something vague like that. And then to let them know it's over with. Our decision was that we have found nothing wrong. We have found these. Because if they find something that's, in a shooting where the person is guilty, you're going to know he's guilty because he's going to go to trial. So, I mean, even then. It needs to be something where they can just give transparency to the citizens without prejudicing the police in any way or the person or persons involved.
Now they do let. It's not as though this is something that happens to everyone.
No.
Because there are citizens that file complaints. They are
just because
successfully,
the sky
is blue. Yeah, they are successfully internally investigated, and there are decisions made. And it's at that point
that they even know.
Oh, the citizen.
Yeah.
Well, it's at that point that the citizen has the opportunity because the police department should inform them and is required to inform them. And
they're required to inform them?
Yes.
Now, say that again. They're required to inform them when a decision is made in the favor of the citizen?
Or any decision whatsoever. And,
oh, they are.
Yeah.
I was under the impression that they're not informed.
Well, the thing is that we know of 1,400 complaints or over 1,400 complaints in the last 16 years.
Right.
We don't know how many more were forgotten.
Right. Okay.
Those 1,400,
right.
There were final decisions approved by the police chief,
okay.
And citizens had an opportunity or should have been informed. And so we don't know either if of all the 1,400, everyone was fully informed, or even if they were informed, if they were understood their right to appeal to the Citizens Review Board. But of those 1,400, assuming that they all did, which I think might be a stretch, of those 1,400, only 78 actually appealed.
78 citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but let me get this wrapped this around my head again. Was it out of the 1,400?
Yes.
We don't know if any of them were informed about the decision, but 78.
They are required to be informed.
They're required.
Of the fact.
And
yes.
That's in the statute.
It is. It's within police directives.
In police directives. So
they are required to be informed of their right to appeal, but we don't know.
The citizens can appeal.
Citizens,
okay,
yes. If,
right.
If they disagree with the final decision of internal affairs, which is signed off on
right.
by the police chief,
right.
They have the opportunity to appeal. But
only if they know.
If they well, the police department is tasked with informing them. However, the information is no more than a letter. And not only do we not know if people understand the process,
right.
If they receive the letters,
right.
or if they are educated on how, you know, say I understand the process, but educated in as much as having the letter educate them
right.
on how it works, then once again, it's another aspect of folks falling through the cracks. We know that of 1,400, and so, you know, the figures don't lie. It's just how are you going to interpret them? Of the 1,400, over a 16-year period, only 78 actually appealed.
Appeal, and who do they appeal to?
They appeal to the Citizens Review Board.
But if the Citizens Review Board has no power, I might as well go to Horn and Hardock's or Hardy. I mean, why go to them when they can't do anything?
Therein lies the problem.
Okay. Now, we're saying that the Citizens Review Board, well, let me back off there for a minute here. This I'm still trying to get myself around this 1,400 here. We got, I'll give you a for instance. When I was in first year of high school, I was system manager at A&P in New York City, Brooklyn. And the manager used to say, by then you had to punch the register what the price was on top of the can or whatever the bread was, and you had to take out money, give cash. The machine didn't tell you this is the change you give. You had to count. Okay? So one thing he used to say all the time, like, I'm not worried about people getting short. I'm worried about people being over because I don't know how much they're over.
Yeah.
Stay here. I mean, how much over 1,400 are we? 5,000?
I believe that somewhere it's like 1,450, something like that.
No, when I say 1,400 complaints, there could have been 5,000 complaints.
Oh, for all we know.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
So the thing is that if you're not keeping track, I mean, this is bad as the daggone Dick Cheney and the Bush administration
in
Iraq, where they sent, I think it's up to $700 billion is missing. They just wrapped it in bubble wrap and shipped it over in a 130 and started giving out. They don't know who they gave it to, and they don't know how much who got what.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the same thing here. We have an agency of this city that has investigatory powers, but we do not know when we make a complaint if they are even investigating the entire thing. Mm-hmm. Hey, Lord knows, I hope they investigated and that's all there was. But if you don't have transparency, they can't even prove it. All they're saying is, yeah, we did it. But, the clock is always right twice a day. But that don't mean that you're going to be right those other 22, 23 hours.
Well, part of the problem, too, is the fact that any documentation that is collected or any documentation that is drawn or drafted by internal affairs isn't discoverable by a citizen. If
That's
you
right.
want to have access to that information, you have to file a civil lawsuit.
Right.
And so there is certainly a lack of transparency there as well. And let's be clear about it. Not everybody can afford to hire an attorney to file a civil lawsuit.
Okay. So, but what would happen if you had an attorney that filed a civil lawsuit for 1,400 people? A massive civil lawsuit. Want to see the results of those cases. Because I think that Mayberry would have to think of a different tactic. Because this is now, this really is Mayberry. And I've said this 1,001 times. Mayberry on steroids. We're no longer, this is the 17th largest city in the country. We cannot act like we're still in mm-hmm. Mayberry. Andy is not the sheriff. Now, getting to the DA. The DA is an elected official.
Mm-hmm.
So, he don't answer anybody but the people. Now, his job is to prosecute cases brought before him. He's not going to go out and seek cases, but he should work hand in hand with the sheriff or with the police chief.
Mm-hmm.
But if the police chief is not giving him the information, about prosecutorial cases, whether the from the police department or the sanitation department. I mean, he can't prosecute, or she can't prosecute. So what is the feeling, your feeling, I just have a personal feeling that the DA, if anything, can do about this?
The DAs aren't allowed to act without the police department fulfilling, either through an individual going through the criminal magistrate's office with a warrant, or the police department fulfilling an investigation and handing that investigation over to the DA's office. I don't believe that this is an issue that can be solved through the district attorney's office.
Right.
It's something that really falls upon the shoulders of city council at the end of the day. And I think that...
Well, the city manager.
I believe city council.
Well, see, this is where this Mayberry comes in at. Because we have a city manager
mm-hmm.
who's supposed to be doing all this. Then we have a city council that the city manager answers to, but only sometimes. And it's like, who's on first again?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the city council is going to write the statutes, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then which the city manager is supposed to follow.
Yes.
Which he directs the police chief to follow.
Yes.
So the police chief answers to the city manager.
Yes.
Or does he answer only to the city council?
I would argue more directly to city council. And what I mean by that is you can certainly, as a member of city council, you can go to committee, have staff through the city manager's office draft up ordinances that controls exactly what the police department or any
mm-hmm.
municipal department, what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly at the end of the day, when the statistics regarding internal affairs, so the 1400,
mm-hmm.
or any decisions of the Citizens Review Board, when those statistics are available, they are addressed to members of city council.
Okay, so realistically, the manager is nothing but an administrator.
And
because the police chief isn't answering directly to him.
I'll give him more credit than that, you know.
He has no power. He's going to only do what the city council tells him to do. City council
mm-hmm.
says this is a statute.
Yeah, they direct. If
he crosses
the mayor
and
city council.
Mm-hmm. Well, mayor, please, weak mayor. He has got nothing to say about nothing. This is Mayberry again. This is not New York City or California. This man, the city council, is the final arbiter. They write the statute. They direct the city, the city manager. This is the statute. Put it in your books.
Yes. Yeah.
And I know the police chief isn't going to call the city manager. He's going to call somebody on the city council. He ain't going to bother with the city manager.
Mm-hmm.
Forget him.
Yeah.
I mean, he's an administrator because these other people can't do the job. Because they're all working. They got other jobs. Because
mm-hmm.
they only pay them $5 a minute, $5 an hour.
I'm of the opinion that's where the buck stops.
Right. You're absolutely correct. So the citizen needs to complain to the city council.
Correct.
And only to the city council, because all this other stuff is just stuff to get in your way.
It's
confusion.
It's window dressing.
It's window dressing. Now, has this been ever... I understand. When was it? When did you go before the city council?
It was on the 1st of April. It was about 10 or 12 days
ago. Yeah, this is the 11th. What happened at your city council meeting?
Well,
What was the purpose?
Yeah, well, the purpose is to make city council aware of the problem and to hopefully have them appreciate the enormity of it. We put together a coalition of local organizations and a list of speakers. And these speakers spoke on issues that pertain to them personally,
mm-hmm.
on issues that pertain to the community at large, and on issues pertaining more specifically to the ordinance and what can be done to address the problem. And to be clear, the problem here is that our board, the arbiter of last resort for any citizen that is unsatisfied with the internal affairs investigation that's conducted on their complaint,
mm-hmm.
if of course their complaint is heard
right.
and an investigation
right.
is conducted,
that's right.
That is their only place they can turn is the Citizens Review Board.
But you see, this is where I have a problem. They're not an elected body.
No.
The place that you should turn to, because we now know the Citizens Review Board is a joke, they need to go to the city council.
Well, that's
because
what we're doing.
The people elect these people.
Absolutely.
They are the people who need to fall or rise under this pressure.
Yes.
Not the Citizens Review Board is a joke. I mean, just speaking to you, and as a member, a former person to help start this, that wasn't what we had in mind when we
Bingo. It's about giving the Citizens Review Board the power it needs to fulfill its purpose.
Absolutely correct.
And the only folks that can actually do that are the members of City Council. When we went to City Council on April 1st, we did that, and we asked for community involvement and support, and we had a tremendous outpouring of support. The reason why we did that was because it is, and it was, the public's last opportunity to let the representatives, our City Council members, know how we feel. When it goes to committee and it has been referred to the council manager committee, when it goes to committee for consideration, the public, the general public, doesn't have an opportunity to speak. And in those committee meetings, we can still have a showing of support, but we had to make sure on April 1st that the message was heard resoundingly loud and clear that this board needs teeth. And it's not just about the check, because certainly this is, you know, fundamental within our principles of government. It's a check and balances. Mm-hmm. We need to have a check. But it's also about the faith in our governmental institutions. We know that there are certain parts of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg community that have completely lost faith with our municipal police force and even City Hall. The erosion within that faith needs to be rebuilt and restored, and this is how City Council can do it. I believe we can all win here. It's just a matter of making sure that it gets done, and it gets done in a meaningful way.
Well, on April the 1st, when you went there, it was All Fool's Day, but when you went there, what feelings did you get from, well, first of all, were all the City Council people present?
Not all. I'd say the vast majority of them were there.
Vast majority.
The mayor was there. Mayor Pro Tem, and a number
How
of
many?
Others. Off the top of my head, I think nine of the 11, and then the mayor.
Okay. Did they ask any questions?
They did. At first, what happened was, before the opportunity for us to speak, the police department, in conjunction with the Citizens Review Board, gave a presentation on what the review board does, and they.
Private citizens now heard what this review board did, and they. Well, wait a minute.
The bullet point.
Are we in the right? yeah. We're in Mayberry here. What's going on?
We entered Oz.
So they gave.
I think what it boiled down to. Right. Yeah.
They gave bullet points. Yeah, they gave bullet points. They didn't give a review page by page. They just gave a bullet point. Listen, it can't be that big. I mean, come on, they could have said the whole thing, because what I'm seeing here is like it can't be over three pages. I mean, so what did they say? What kind of review did they get?
Well, we heard numbers and we heard the process. We're not arguing with the process. We're just saying the process can be perfected,
right?
And perfected in a meaningful way. And it wasn't until we had an opportunity to speak that I think City Council fully started to gain an appreciation for the problem.
Right.
There is a board. We understand what they're tasked to do. Mm-hmm. However, they don't have the tools to complete the task at hand. And so we had a number of speakers who addressed those points in their were questions, and that's what we were hoping for. We were hoping for an open dialogue and discussion, and I was encouraged, because Patrick Cannon, he wanted to press this forward, because of the fact that we have addressed the issue and we have listed out what the problems here are. And I was encouraged by the fact that he was willing to take a stand and say, let's go ahead, send this to committee, and get this done in the first committee meeting. Mm-hmm. However, that is not where we are. And so there will be a longer process to this. We're talking about the city manager meeting with stakeholders over a 90-day period.
Stakeholder, who's stakeholder? Who is our stakeholder?
That's been my question.
Well, what stakeholders here? I mean, who's getting paid?
It's code, as far as I know.
Duh.
And I have always been of the opinion that the community and those of us who are
community
in the
community is the stakeholders.
Exactly, we're the stakeholders. I thought that we had spoken loud and clear as to having the ordinance for the Citizens Review Board redrafted in the way that we would like to see it redrafted. But I guess there are others who need to weigh in.
There's somebody that the city council has to check with?
We are right now in the process of trying to figure out who the stakeholders are.
They use the word stakeholders?
Yes.
Pat, you can't use that because I'm going to have him on the show. I will ask him that question.
It was a consensus, is what I'll say. I can't say specifically. I believe that it was the mayor who asked the city manager to meet with stakeholders to discuss the issue so they have a clearer understanding of how they will want to redraft the ordinance. We have already built a coalition of numerous organizations, and there are numerous more that we're hoping will jump on board. And I think that from the standpoint of the NAACP, the standpoint of Democracy North Carolina, among others, the Charlotte School of Law, we have addressed this issue as stakeholders, and we hope that this isn't a long, drawn-out process that ends up being meaningless and getting us nowhere.
And now the North Carolina Black Leadership Caucus, that I just happen to be the new president of,
mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying, when we say stakeholders, I mean, that the only stakeholder other than the citizens are the police.
So
they're
going
to work
know.
With the police to draft this?
I don't know.
I mean, this is the job of the city council. I know they don't get paid nothing, but the problem is they need to make the ordinance. I mean, it's like the legislature right now, the daggone House, the U.S. House. That they're talking about how to drop this the gun laws. Oh, they're going to sit down with the NRA?
Yeah.
I mean, they're the ones that draft the laws. The NRA doesn't, but they do sit down with the NRA. Now, that's the problem. You don't sit down with the person who has caused the problem to draft a law so the one who caused the problem can get around the law. So this is really outrageous.
Yeah.
Now,
it's always been this way, though, hasn't it, Mike?
Well, you see, here's the thing. When we sat down originally, 96, 97, whatever the heck it was, none of that came. Everybody was for this because
yeah.
We had a couple of shootings here, and the people were up in arms, and that's what caused this to come together originally.
And we're still having shootings, and that's just it, is that I don't understand. It has confused me. To no ends,
mm-hmm.
Why we aren't seeing more political support here with our city council members backing this and backing it in a real strong way to get it done. I hope that over the next couple of months we see some council members championing this particular issue.
No, this is Michael Barnes works with the DA's office, doesn't he?
No, he worked for he ran for district attorney.
He ran for district attorney. Yeah. That's right. He's private practice. Okay. Well, it seems to me that the process there's roadblocks being thrown in
in the middle of you going down the stream here.
I hope not. I hope not. We are trying so hard to make this
work.
Because
when we hear the word stakeholders, we hear these other code words, this doesn't make any sense when you're supposed to write the daggone legislation.
Give me 2 days, I'd make it happen. That's all I'm saying. It's not complicated.
This ain't rocket science.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not rocket science. All you want, there needs to be a place for the citizens to get redress.
Absolutely.
Period.
Yes, sir.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to put it in somewhere there. Okay?
If there's one, you know, there are a number of proposals that we're asking for. We're asking for the standard of review to be lower. And that was something that I
standard of review to be lower. What do you mean by that?
Well, right now there is a standard, and it's confusing because the Citizens Review Board, they first review whether or not they're going to hear a case.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they review whether or not they're going to hear a case, then they hear the case and then apply a standard to the case they've heard to decide whether or not they will make an advisory opinion to the police department to overturn a decision. Once again, it's simply an advisory opinion. Nothing compels the police department to actually follow through with any advice. However, we've never gotten that far. Of the 78 cases that have been appealed, only 4 have gone beyond the simple process of determining whether there will even be a hearing. Only 4. And of those 4, of course, not a single one of them has there been a result where the Citizens Review Board has sided with the citizen. But having said that, at both stages, it's the same standard of review, which is by preponderance of the evidence, they have to consider whether or not the police chief has abused his discretion. And in reality, board members have told us this. A board member spoke in front of city council and addressed this matter, two of them actually, addressed this matter and said that standard, the abuse of discretion language, is way too high. There have been instances where they believe they would have had a different result. The decision would have been different if that standard wasn't so high. Now, having said that, you know, that's the first issue. The second one, I think we might have touched on this, is independent investigatory power. There is no power for the Citizens Review Board to compel an officer who has a complaint lodged against them to compel an officer to speak to them. No subpoena power. No power to conduct their own independent investigation. And the one that the most contentious issue as far as I'm concerned and the preeminent one of them all is the fact that our Citizens Review Board has nothing more than an advisory role. They need to be able, just like the Civil Service Board, we have other governmental agencies within Charlotte that have the ability to overturn a police decision and do it regularly. The Citizens Review Board needs to have the same power, or else they're just a red herring. There's no teeth there. It doesn't matter if you have a lower standard. It doesn't matter if they have investigatory powers if the police department is not compelled to follow through with their final decision.
All right. So the Civil Service Board deals with civil service employees that have violated civil service laws?
No. It's my understanding that civil service employees, and we're talking about the police department specifically, whenever a police officer has been terminated, they have an opportunity to appeal their termination to the Civil Service Board.
Yeah, I understand. But what I'm saying is that realistically, they and that's only because they're going to pay them a pension or not. That's the reason why that is. I mean, but if someone, say, God forbid, a policeman shoots somebody and he admits it, well, then the civil service will get involved and say, yeah, for that, because you're a violation of code such and such,
mm-hmm.
dereliction of duty, we're killing your pension. But that's the only teeth that they have. They're not going to go, well, okay, this guy's up because I think he was running narcotics out of Joe's backyard. Well, maybe narcotics, but I mean, he stole something out of the store. They're not going to get involved in that. So I really think even the Civil Service Board is not on the same page as a Citizen Review Board, because a Citizen Review Board needs to meet directly with the police department. When you throw all these other things in the mix here, the Civil Service Retirement the Civil Service Board, they are the last man on the totem pole, because they will be told when all this other stuff has come down and been resolved. Then they say, yeah, okay, well, he violated this law, so he can lose his pension for that. But the Civil Service, this Citizen Review Board, needs to have teeth where they can go and meet with the police department and get all the facts in front of them.
Absolutely. My confusion, I think, lies in the fact that the Civil Service Board, it's a board that has been established to allow police officers to retain their pensions.
Right.
And so we're talking about a board that will review whether or not a police officer can do that because they've been terminated, and then can, depending upon whether or not they believe that the police department made the right decision, they can overturn the police department decision. So we're talking about a protection for the individual police officer.
When it only goes to the pension, they can't say, oh, you go back to work.
Oh, they can. They can overturn a decision, have a police officer no longer be terminated, and, of course, keep the pension.
Well, wait a minute here. Wait a minute. They're all civil service employees, so they all work for the city.
Mm-hmm.
That means, but the Civil Service Board is supposed to be working for the city, not for the employees of the city.
Well, they're not paid. It's just like the Citizens Review Board. It's an auxiliary board of the city government.
What I'm saying is we're working for the city. I don't mean monetarily wise, but they're supposed to watch the greenbacks that the city puts out. I mean, civil service.
They all do. It just depends on, are we talking about a lawsuit, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, I remember working in the federal government. I was the EEO person where I worked, and whenever something happened, hey, they told me. I didn't go to the Civil Service Retirement Fund. They were the last people to know about anything. Because they should not get involved in this. Their job is only if the person is going to be terminated.
Mm-hmm.
Then they get involved. And they do not say whether or not the person should be terminated or not. They are directed whether the person should be terminated or not. And what happens if he is terminated. Not whether or not, no, we don't think that's right. Nonsense. I mean, you see, this thing is all backwards here. That's the job of the Citizen Review Board.
All I'm saying is, where's the protection for the citizens?
Okay, there is no protection. Because
absolutely,
the protection is the Citizens Review Board.
Yes.
Now.
Which has no power.
According to this, what I'm reading in front of me here, it says there were seven issues that were asked of the Citizens Review Board. Is that right?
City Council.
City Council, mm-hmm. I should say. Broader eligibility requirements for cases to heard before the board. Second, a standard of review lower than abuse of discretion for the board to apply. Third, independent investigatory power for the board, i.e. a power to subpoena and bring their own cases. Four, more than a mere advisory role if misconduct is ever found. Five, discover the complainants so they have an idea of what allegations the police are making prior to any hearing. Due process.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Due process, I think, is in the Constitution. Six, legal representation for complainants who can't afford counsel if they want it. Seven, transparency of board members, public knowledge, disclosure who they are, where they're from, and what they do as an occupation, much like is already done by city council members. Now, they're not asking for the moon here. And if we don't know who the people are behind the curtain, this is ours. This is completely nonsense.
No accountability.
No accountability at all. None. these people might as well meet at Hardee's.
Mm-hmm.
Do they meet? Do we know that?
They do meet, but we don't know when.
And don't know
that's
where.
That's not public knowledge. There is no set schedule, so they meet when they agree to. What we did find out was that they have been meeting 4 times a year. That was disclosed during the city council meeting on the 1st. But that's subject
to
change.
Have to or not, they meet 4 times a year.
That's our understanding. But what we do know, and this is what's interesting, is that when you look at the number of cases over a 16-year period, you're talking about them meeting to consider even reviewing a case about 4 cases per year. And so they meet just to consider whether or not to review one, 4 of them per year. And then over that 16-year period, they've actually heard 1 every 4 years.
So what happened to the rest of them?
Well, you know, they have been lost between the cracks.
What were some of the questions that were brought up at on April the 1st by the citizens?
Well, on April the 1st, what we did was we outlined these proposals for city council. We had a number of folks from the Citizens Review Board Clinic at the School of Law who talked more in depth about the legal underpinnings of those proposals, and then we had individuals from the community there was one in particular who had been in front of the board, had a hearing, and had her case denied. It was
in front
egregious,
of the citizen.
In front of the Citizens Review Board.
Oh, so she actually she saw
she
physical
made
peoples?
She made it. Yes, she made it.
Did she take down names?
No. She didn't. She didn't get names. She said that she didn't have an opportunity to hear the police's case. She said that she was actually her head was spinning when it was all said and done because she comes from a municipal background. Her father was a fire chief in the small town where she grew up, and so she's always trusted the city government. She's always trusted the police. But she said that this was an instance that just it floored her. She doesn't feel in. This is, I think, to boil it down in one sentence. She says she does not feel comfortable. She lives in North County. Mm-hmm. She does not feel comfortable coming into Charlotte any longer because of the police. And I think that's a problem. And it's a problem that needs to be addressed. And it's due directly to the system, internal affairs, and then the lack of any authority whatsoever on behalf of the Citizens Review Board.
When is the next meeting with the City Council, or where do they leave it at the end?
Right now, it's going to be. It's been referred to the Council Manager Committee. In the meantime, the Council Manager Committee.
What is Council Manager?
It's a committee that doesn't meet on a regular basis. So we have to stay on top of the meeting schedule for that committee with city staff, the mayor. The mayor is the chair of that committee. I can tell you the makeup if you would like.
Yes, I would like to have the makeup.
It's the mayor. Mayor's the chair. Smudgy Mitchell, David Howard, Patsy Kinsey, and Warren Cooksey. And they don't meet on a regular basis. We do know that their next meeting will be on the 22nd. It'll be on the 22nd. It's scheduled for the 22nd at 11:45 a.m. in room 280 at the Government Center. However, this will not be on the agenda. The mayor had asked that the city manager conduct a 90-day, no longer than 90-day study, where he is to meet with stakeholders. We're still trying to figure out who those
stakeholders are.
But we'll meet with stakeholders to make a recommendation to the mayor regarding how this ordinance should be changed, and then they will place it on the agenda for the council manager committee.
But wait a minute, isn't that the job of the city council to change the ordinance?
Yes. Yeah.
Who are the stakeholders then? I mean, why are these stakeholders going to give reasons to? I mean,
we're trying to become a stakeholder is what we're trying to do at this point, which is sad.
All right, well, what we're going to do is that we are going to
come back to this. Mm-hmm. When is your next scheduled appointment to see anybody anywhere?
I'll be speaking with some Democrats.
A dark alleyway in a dark room somewhere, as Mitt Romney, maybe?
I don't know. I do everything out in the open. but I'll be speaking with a young Democrat.
Well, the stakeholders are not out in the open. They're in a dark room. Yeah. So you might just speak to a peephole or something.
If we can get into that dark room with an issue like this, then we're going to do everything we can to pry that door open and get in.
Okay.
I will be speaking with young Democrats in 45 minutes, and tomorrow I will be at there's the Legacy and Trailblazer.
When is that? What time is that?
That's at 6:30 tomorrow night.
Where is that at?
At Mr. Ferguson's home, and I have this.
You know what? I saw something about this. Somebody sent me something like that.
Yeah, it's 1122 River Oaks Lane. I believe it's $35. It's being hosted by the County Democratic Party.
Oh. Right.
I'll be there. I'm actually being honored.
Oh,
yeah, I know. Imagine that.
Send me that, because I'm going to see if I can come to that tomorrow night. My show's over at 6. Where's the address?
It's. I'll write it down for you.
Yeah, write it down for me. Okay. All right. What we're going to do is we are going to end our conversation here, and then when the next meeting occurs, we need to have another conversation about this to see where we're at. And in the meantime, since our mayor pro tem gave me a call, which I have not returned yet, I'm going to speak to him about this and see where he is at and see if he knows who the stakeholders are.
And that was the interview with Matt Newton. We're going to hear more from Matt in a few days. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to see if I can get a hold of our Mayor Pro Tem, the Honorable Patrick Canning, and see what he has to say about the Civilian Review Board. But right now, we only have a few minutes left, and I just want to say April 15th, today, well, not today, but April 15th was the actual day where segregation met its match, where the civil rights movement really got off its butt and started to mean something. 1947, April 15th, a gentleman, and I mean a gentleman, a lieutenant in the Army, a man who fought for his country, a man who played basketball, football, and baseball, and at 28 years of age, became the first black man in Major League Baseball. I'm talking about Jackie Roosevelt Robinson, born January 31st, 1919, and in Cairo, Georgia, made his debut for the Brooklyn Dodgers. I mean, we're talking about somebody that had career stats, batting average of .311, had 1,518 hits, had 137 home runs, batted 734 runs in, and stole 197 bases. Was on the All-Star team 6 times, 1949, 1950, 1951, 1952, 1953, 1954. He was a world champion with the Dodgers in 1955. He was the MVP in 1949. He was the Rookie of the Year in Major Leagues in 1947, when they only gave one Rookie of the Year. 1949, he was also the batting champion. He was two-time Major League Stolen Base Champion, 1947 and 1949. And is to this day, the only person in Major League Baseball that had his number retired. The only one in Major League Baseball that every single team, their number 42, no one can wear it. That number is retired on every single team. Jackie Robinson ran track, as I said before. He ran, he played football, he played basketball, and he played baseball. Baseball wasn't even his best sport. Football and track was his best sport. But, you know, it's just incredible. It's just incredible the things that this gentleman did. He went to UCLA in 1939. He transferred to UCLA, I guess it would be the Bruins, where he became the school's first athlete to win the varsity letters in four sports. As I said, track, baseball, football, and baseball, basketball, football, and track. He was one of four black players in 1939 for the Bruins football team. Under Woody, he played with Woody Strode, the that everybody might know, famous actor. And he was the only one of a handful of players that existed in mainstream college football. While a senior at UCLA, Robinson met his future wife, Rachel. And as a UCLA freshman who was familiar with Robinson's athletic career, In his spring semester in 41, despite his mother and Rachel's reservation, Robinson left college just shy of graduation, and he took a job as an assistant athletic director with the government's National Youth Administration. After the government ceased, after the National Youth Administration operation ceased, Robinson traveled to Honolulu in the fall of 41 to play football for the semi-professional, racially integrated Honolulu Bears. And by that time, however, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor after he came back home. And what did he say? I had to end my career and help the United States. In 1942, he was drafted and was assigned to a segregated Army cavalry unit at Fort Riley, Kansas. But, although the Army, in those days, few black applicants were admitted to OCS after the directive by the Army. As a result, Robinson and his colleagues were delayed for several months for going to the OCS. He was backed by Joe Lewis, the famous heavyweight champion. And with this recommendation and the help from Truman Gibson, then who was the civilian aide to the Secretary of War, Robinson was able to go to OCS, finish OCS, and became a second lieutenant in 1943. Then his wife, Rachel, said, you know, I guess I can marry you. You're doing all right. But, you know, then his career was derailed when the racists in the Army, especially in some parts of the Army had developed its own bus line that was not segregated. When he went on the bus at one time, the driver told him to go to the back of the bus, and Robinson refused. Not someone that would just turn the other cheek. Not yet. Robinson later confronted the investigating officer about this, because when the bus got into their final destination, the bus driver told the military police that Robinson caused a ruckus on the bus. They took him into custody, and the officer recommended that Robinson be court-martialed. After Robinson's commander of the 761st refused to authorize the legal action, Robinson was summarily transferred to the 758th Battalion, where the commander quickly consented to charge Robinson with multiple offenses, including charges of public drunkenness. And Robinson did not drink. By the time the court-martial ended in August of 1944, the charges against Robinson were reduced to two counts of insubordination, during questioning. Robinson was acquitted by all white 9-member officer panel. The experiences Robinson was subjected to during the court proceedings would be remembered when he later joined Major League Baseball and was subjected to the same racist attacks. After the acquittal, he was transferred to Camp Breckenridge in Kentucky, where he served as a coach of the Army Athletics until receiving an honorable discharge in 1944. Robinson then returned to football with the Los Angeles Bulldogs, where he accepted offers from his old friend and Pastor Reverend Carl Downs to be the athletic director. Robinson always knew he wanted to have something to do with sports. They said they loved him, but he was definitely a disciplinarian. In 1945, while Robinson was at Sam Houston College, the Kansas City Monarchs sent him a written offer to play professional baseball in the Negro Leagues, and he accepted the contract for $400 per month. A boom for him at the time. Robinson, during that time, pursued a professional baseball career with major league interest. The Boston Red Sox held out a tryout at Fenway for Robinson and for other black players. The tryouts, however, were farce. It was a fraud. Other teams, however, were more serious interested in signing black players. In 1940s, Branch Rickey Club, the Brooklyn Dodgers. Branch Rickey was the president and general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers. Began to scout the Negro Leagues for a possible addition to the Dodgers roster. Rickey selected Robinson from the list of promising black players and interviewed him for a possible assignment to the Brooklyn International League Farm Club, the Montreal Royals. Robinson was not the best ball player in the Negro Leagues. As my father often told me, no way. He was a good ball player, but he was not the best. They had guys that could rip the leather off the ball, could run faster than him, could hit better than him, and could feel better than him. But Robinson was probably in the top 10 ball players in Major League Baseball when he got there with the rest of the white ball players in the National and American League. Rickey said, I did not offer compensation to the Monarchs, instead believing all Negro League players were free agents due to the contracts not containing a reserve clause. Among those Rickey discussed prospects with was Wendell Smith, writer for the Black Weekly Pittsburgh Courier, who, according to Cleveland Indians owner and team president Bill Veeck, influenced Rickey to take Robinson, for which he never completely got credit. So Bill Veeck, who was another great owner and team president of the Cleveland Indians, later signed another ball player that was became the first ball player in the American League, Larry Doby. But there were plenty of great ball players in the Negro Leagues. Josh Gibson, Satchel Paige, of course, Larry Doby. But Robinson became the man. And when he was called up by the Dodgers in April 1947 to play the first game, this is where segregation came under attack, and this is where Jackie Robinson started the actual civil rights movement in this country. 6 days before the start of the 1947 season, the Dodgers called Robinson up to the major leagues. With Eddie Stanky and Trent at second base for the Dodgers, Robinson played his initial major league season at first base. There's a short part in the film that I can talk to you about of the Jackie number 42 that came out today. He gets spiked at first base. The guy runs over his foot on purpose. He can hardly walk. His teammates come around him and say, I believe it might have been Pee Reese or Billy Cox, I don't remember, told the pitcher, next guy comes up, hit him in the head. And Robinson says, no, we're going to beat them. Help me up. They helped him up. He was in pain and bleeding that entire time, but played the rest of the game and got a couple of hits. So This is the man. He was playing for the team, not for himself. Robinson played everywhere. He played first base, second base, shortstop, third base, every outfield position. He didn't catch or pitch, but he was there. He didn't get a base hit in his first major league play. He walked and scored a run in the Dodgers' 5-3 victory. And Robinson became the first player since 1888 to openly break the Major League Baseball color line. Black fans began to flock to Ebbets Field to see the Dodgers when they were in town and abandoned their Negro League teams. Now, it was amazing. I remember seeing some of these games. Really, I didn't start watching until like the 52, 51. So I was with my father, and we had the first TV in my class, so we saw some of these games. Now, I don't know how many people out there remember Leo DeRocher. Leo DeRocher became major. He was a Dodger fan. I mean, he was a Dodger player, I should say. But he also went over to the dark side, to the Giants, and became their manager later on. But Leo DeRocher said one time, "I don't care if the guy is yellow or black, or if he has stripes like a effing zebra. I'm the manager of this team, and I say he plays. What's more, I say he can make us all rich. And if any of you cannot use the money, I will see that you are all traded." Leo DeRocher was the manager. Okay. Robinson also derided by opposing teams. Some, notably the St. Louis Cardinals, threatened to strike if Robinson played. National League Ford Frick, president to commissioner, and Happy Chandler, let it be known that if any striking players would be suspended, Robinson nonetheless became the target of rough physical play, at one time receiving 7-inch gas in his leg from Enos Slaughter. On April 22, 1947, during the game between the Dodgers and the Philadelphia Phillies players, Robinson was called nigger from the dugout and yelled at. You should go back to the cotton fields. Robinson talked freely about Larry Doby, who endured his own hardships since becoming the first black player in the American League with the Cleveland Indians. Talked to one another via telephone calls. Ricky later recalled that if the Philadelphia manager Ben Chapman did more than anybody to unite the Dodgers when they were on the field. They even had a black cat that they set out from the dugout. But the Dodgers, the teammates, Pee Wee Reese, once came to Robinson's defense with his famous line, "You can hate a man for many reasons. Color is not one of them." Reese put his arm around Robinson in the middle of the ballpark to show fans who shouted racial slurs at Robinson before a game in Cincinnati that he was with them. So there were plenty of things that Robinson endured. But he brought that team together. In his first Major League Baseball season, he played 151 games for the Dodgers. He batted .297. He had an on-base percentage of .383. And he had a slugging percentage of .427. He had 175 hits, and he scored 125 runs. That means he touched home plate himself 125 times, including 31 doubles, 5 triples, 12 home runs, driving in 48 runs for the year. Robinson led the league in sacrifice hits with 28 and in stolen bases with 29. What more can you ask for someone when you have never been in a position like this before? His cumulative performance earned him the inaugural Major League Baseball Rookie of the Year Award, separate from the National American League Rookies of the Year honors, were not awarded until 1949. So in 1947, of all the new players in Major League Baseball, Robinson received the only award for Rookie of the Year. I mean, this is completely amazing. The racial prejudice of Robinson were erased in 1948 as a member of other and other black players came to the major leagues, like Larry Doby in the American League, July 5th, 1947, just 11 weeks after Robinson did. Satchel Paige played for the Cleveland Indians. And the Dodgers had three other black players besides Robinson. In February 48, he signed a $12,500 contract, equal to $119,000 today with the Dodgers. While a significant amount, this was less than Robinson made in the offseason on the Vanderbilt Tour when he answered preset baseball questions and was on a speaking tour in the South. Between the tours, he underwent surgery on his right ankle. And that right ankle was due to that being stepped on in that Philadelphia Philly game. In 1948, he raised his average from 296 to 342 and won the MVP. And Robinson stole 37 bases, was second in the league in both doubles and triples, and registered 124 runs batted in and 122 runs scored. For that performance, he got the MVP in the National League. Baseball fans also voted Robinson as the starting second baseman for the 1949 All-Star Game, the first All-Star Game to include black players. So when I say that Robinson was the one who started the civil rights movement in this country, Robinson, Jackie Roosevelt Robinson, started the civil rights movement in this country, and it has not turned back. This is Michael Lawson with the last word, along with Thomas Fortenberry. Go out and see 42. You're going to love it.
No doubt about it, satisfaction's guaranteed. By Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Chevrolet.